Time once again for none other than John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Beep.
Beep. Beep, beep. We're trying to mimic the spirit land or connect with Earth.
Yeah.
So we're just going to do a half hour of these beeps.
Exactly. Yeah. I still have a theory that the reason it shut down is it came up on the backside of the Bush family estate that Prescott ran off to Mars with, you know, top rocket Nazi rocket scientists in the late 40s. And all his son and grandson have wanted to do ever since is try and get back to the family home.
All right, you're going to be writing about that later this week in the Weekly?
No, but there's a few good internet conspiracy sites where that would probably fly and spread like wildfire. Yeah. And, you know,
we all know Bush is an alien, right?
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. And anyway.
He acts like one.
He certainly thinks like one.
That's true.
But anyway.
All right.
It was an interesting week for alien thought processes, that's for sure. We'll get to some of that, I suspect.
Okay. Well, let's start with our state. We'll talk about the State of the Union later. There was a surprising to find in the front page of one of our local newspapers some revelations about a further Boeing bonus package.
Yes, folks might remember that last year the state legislature voted $3.2 billion in tax cuts for Boeing in order to win the 787 plant here in the state of Washington. Boeing had threatened to build it elsewhere. That plant's going to provide about 20,000 jobs, which means it averages out to about $160,000 a job in state money as a gift to Boeing. Well, it turns out that the Evergreen Freedom Foundation, a conservative nonprofit based in Olympia, had sued the state under the Freedom of Information Act to try and get their hands on more details of the deal that Governor Gary Locke signed in December about a month ago that gave Boeing more little perks. And the details of that...
Little perks.
Yeah, and the details of that deal had not been disclosed to the public, and the Evergreen Freedom Foundation wanted to find out what was in that package. Well, the state finally released the documents, and it turns out that those little perks are not so little after all. They include $10 million for the state to design and build a training center that will be used exclusively by Boeing to train its 77 employees. And the state will hire and pay the salary of a workforce development coordinator who will help Boeing recruit workers and set up a training program at that facility. Now, that's not all. The State Department of Transportation and the City of Everett are now required to make road improvements for Boeing on I-5 and Highway 527 and other local roads. And Snohomish County has to upgrade Payne Field and build a 30-foot-wide road between the airport, Boeing's factory, and the facilities of its subcontractors and suppliers.
Yeah, and for people who are familiar with that part of our local metropolitan geography, the widest and nicest freeway in Snohomish County is not I-5. It's the freeway that runs alongside the Boeing plant and that connects the Boeing facilities to I-5. That was put there by the state already on behalf of Boeing, and they're talking about expanding those facilities now.
That's right. And then the Port of Everett has to spend some $34 million in order to expand its south terminal to handle Boeing cargo shipments from Japan, which currently come through the Tacoma Port and the Port of Seattle without any trouble and just get barged up to Everett. But Everett has to spend $34 million so that Boeing can save on a few transportation costs. Now, certain parts of this deal are still secret. So when the Evergreen Freedom Foundation got all of these documents, there were portions of the documents that were blacked out, and much of...
National security, perhaps?
No, for Boeing security. And a large part of that is details on this $10 million training facility and training center, which is the big part of the deal. And there may be other costly portions of this package that were blacked out that we simply can't know about. So, and what's really unfortunate is Governor Gary Locke has requested $6 million from the state legislature to as a down payment on this facility to start building this training facility. And our legislators, Democrats and Republicans alike, have not raised a stink at all. In fact, they've gotten down on their knees and kissed Boeing's behind on this whole thing, saying, oh, we're so happy to have him here. What's an extra $10 million? What's an extra $5 million, et cetera?
At the beginning of... talking about this. I think you said 20,000 jobs from that. I thought it was like 2,000 jobs.
No, they say 20,000 because, you know,
they're talking about the multiplier, the economic effects, I believe.
Yeah. And then some people take that 20,000 figure and then they multiply it again, thinking that Boeing is not figured in the multiplier already, and they say 80,000. So it's becoming more and more blown out of proportion.
Okay, because I'd heard like 1,800 jobs was what was coming out of this. That's what Rick Anderson had reported.
Yeah, the other thing that is most disturbing about this package and the fact that the state budget is providing even more to Boeing than it already is the state biennial next year. We're in the off year of the biennial budget, but next year when the legislature reconvenes, they are, according to current economic projections, and this is in the face of what is ostensibly an economic recovery, they're still looking at another $1 billion shortfall. That's B as in boy, billion, above and beyond the cuts that have already been made in the last two biennial budgets, which have been fairly extreme. They're talking about having to make even more cuts that are very likely to fall in social services and other areas.
To cuts in local spending, like for cities like this, like the city of Everett and Snohomish County and King County and the city of Seattle, that we've had to make.
And even still, the outgoing governor who will not be in office when that budget is made, and Democratic and Republican lawmakers are saying that the corporate welfare that is in the budget, which is the one thing that's been off limits so far through the last two sessions, that is still sacrosanct. The tax breaks for big companies are still sacrosanct. All the money from Boeing, I mean, they're spending even more. It's remarkable.
I have to ask, sticking with this whole multiplier thing, do they use that multiplier when they have the Boeing layoffs, you know, when Boeing cuts 5,000 jobs? Do they then multiply how many jobs have just been killed in the state?
No, they just say, only 5,000 jobs, and the economy will absorb it, et cetera.
Okay. Uh-huh. I need to get that.
They're all being retrained for working fast food outlets and convenience stores.
Yeah, but I understand even McDonald's is cutting back. They're laying off people, so...
Yeah.
What are they being retrained for?
There's another big piece of corporate welfare going on in the state legislature right now. It's the $750 million bill for biotech in order to try and attract biotech firms here. And there is also the renewal of the research and development tax credit for high-tech companies. Now, these two bills are... You know, and as Jobs said, there's a $1 billion shortfall. And these two bills, if they don't pass, then we could plug a large part of that hole. And now the cost to taxpayers of the R&D tax break bill is some $74 million over the next year and a half, and then about $100 million per year after that. And it's important to note that no study has been done on whether or not the research and development tax credit has provided many jobs, who it benefits, who pockets the money, and whether or not it actually helps small, struggling businesses to get started and stay in business, which is what its proponents claim. Now, the interesting thing is, when bills like these don't pass, like the $750 million biotech giveaway, and the R&D tax increase and R&D tax break bill, when bills like this are close to not passing, their supporters always cry and scream and say, well, you know,
these companies, Washington State's unfriendly to business,
right, and these companies will have to pack up and take their jobs elsewhere, et cetera, et cetera. But that doesn't really that's kind of a contradiction when they're saying initially that the bill is supposed to support small businesses. It's not small businesses that have the resources to pack up and move to, you know, Colorado or to India. It's large businesses, big businesses like Amgen, the company that wrote the original bill for the R&D tax increase in the mid-1990s. It's companies like that, big biotech firms, that have the ability to pack up and move to India or Mexico or to some other state. It's not small companies. So it really begs the question of who benefits from this, and it's pretty obvious that in large part it's corporate welfare for large companies like that.
Yeah,
the scale of Boeing's.
Yeah, and we see that also in the B&O tax structure and some of the other state policies where they really are weighted much more toward the very large corporations and in a lot of ways penalize the small businesses.
Yeah, and that's not to say that small businesses don't occasionally benefit from these things, and they do. But the problem is that these bills are not targeted for small businesses. There's no limit as to the size of the company that can receive the benefit. It's always any company within the industry, and it's usually the largest companies that get the most.
Wow, with $750 million from the state going to biotech, and then Seattle proposing about $800 million support for South Lake Union Biotech, sounds like biotech's going to earn the new Lazy Bee ticket from Boeing. So let's jump to national news. The two events happening right at the beginning of the week, the Iowa caucuses and the State of the Union. I know you were both glued to your set Tuesday night.
I was. There was a Friends rerun, as I recall.
I wasn't. I was actually in my kung fu class.
Yeah, I didn't watch it either. I did read the transcript, and I have to say, in the Iowa caucus, that it has been hilarious to watch simultaneously within the sort of chattering political classes that you get on media, filling up the airtime on TV and cable TV. You have on the one hand people talking about, isn't it wonderful how the voters have defied the polls, which is to say the polls didn't really have a clue as to what was happening, and that the voters finally do actually control the process. And so here you then have the media making all kinds of projections as to who is and isn't going to win based upon a very limited sample of a fairly unrepresentative one single state out of the 50 in the country, with any kind of
Iowa Democrats. What are they like? Are they more conservative Democrats, or are they maybe a handful of Democrats?
Are they maybe whiter than the rest of the country? I mean, it really is kind of amazing that so much is projected out of a small and unrepresentative sample. And we're going to get that again on Tuesday with New Hampshire. And by the time the third round of primaries comes around, in a week and a half, we're gonna have somebody anointed as the probable nominee, regardless of what happens. It really does cut out like 40 some states from the process and many of the voters. Even if it was a widespread vote as opposed to a caucus, which also weeds out a lot of the voters, prospective voters in a number of states, including Washington's.
All right. Well, Mr. Bush's speech, were you impressed by what you read?
I was, I don't know if I could stand to listen to it. It was a campaign speech. It was very markedly different than the tone and the content of the last three-year speech. These were the themes that we will see throughout the campaign this year. And there really was this incredible separation between what Bush claims and the actual reality on the ground. I mean, that's nowhere more stark than in the administration's claims for Iraq. And we'll talk, I think, at some length probably about what was going on in Iraq itself this week and how that is shaping up over the next year. But you had David Kaye, who yesterday stepped down formally as the lead person in the Bush administration heading the search for those elusive weapons of mass destruction, saying finally in an interview with Reuters that he does not believe there were any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq at the start of the invasion. This time last year, including in the State of the Union speech, you had Bush stating definitively there was hard evidence, and people throughout the administration, Cheney and Colin Powell and Rumsfeld and everybody else, saying, we have the evidence, waving around sheets of paper, McCarthy style. We have the addresses, we have the types, we have the quantities of these weapons of mass destruction.
We know how many people they could kill.
Yeah.
We know how quickly they could deploy them within 15 minutes, etc.
Yeah, and the whole premise for launching a quote-unquote preemptive invasion, which, under any other premise would have been illegal under not only international law, but really any conceivable type of law, was that Iraq's weaponry, Elmer Fudd slipped in there for a minute, Iraq's weaponry posed an immediate national security threat to the United States. The whole thing about, they could deploy weapons within 45 minutes or whatever figure they pulled out of thin air. This year, President Bush was reduced to talking about how they had destroyed Iraq's weapons of mass destruction related program activities. I mean, you know, how many hedges are within that one particular particular phrase? And here you still have Dick Cheney and Scott McClelland, who's the president's media guy, insisting that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They will be found. And David Kaye, the president's own guy, a man who had been pretty much toting the party line up until the time he spent months scouring Iraq finding nothing, is saying that nothing at all happened. There are a number of things that have gone down the memory hole regarding Iraq. We had news this week, which could lead down the road, and I say could because it also might be a premise to trying to let the thing drop. There's a grand jury that has been convened now in the case of the wife of Joseph Wilson being outed by White House operatives as a CIA agent, and where that leak came from. Well, we know where that leak came from.
Joseph Wilson.
Yes, Joseph Wilson was the former ambassador to Niger. He was ambassador to Niger at one point, along with various other countries, who was sent by George Tenet and by the intelligence agencies to Niger in the summer of 1990, no, the spring of 1990, no, winter, I'm sorry, we're a full year back, of 2002, I'm sorry, 2 years ago. I'm still in the 90s. The winter, early year, about 2 years ago now, of 2002, to investigate this persistent rumor that Niger had sold yellow-caked uranium to Iraq, which could have then been used by the Saddam Hussein regime in the, you know, supposed development of a nuclear weapons program. This was a claim that had been around as a rumor provided by Italian intelligence agencies and further by British intelligence agencies. And Wilson came back and said, no, these are crude forgeries. You know, the papers that supposedly came out of this sale were crude forgeries. The government denies it. It's clear that, you know, there's absolutely no substance to this. That went up the chain of command. And yet last year, in the State of the Union address, most famously, President Bush was still making this claim, even though months beforehand, Wilson had reported to his administration and to the CIA and to the White House that this was a fictitious claim. You now have...
And then Wilson came out and then, said that,
yes,
you know, Bush has the information that says this is not true.
And Bush had it for months before the State
of
the Union.
And so these guys are lying. That's basically what he said.
So now you have...
And then
the,
his wife was outed as a CIA agent.
Yes.
Just suddenly and mysteriously the information was leaked.
Yeah. And so you have now the press accounts coming out of the convening of this grand jury saying that it was in retaliation for Joseph Wilson being critical of the administration's Iraq policies. That, again, is down the memory hole. Wilson was not being critical of the Iraq policies. He was saying that the administration was lying about its rationale for going to war. And you combine that with the obvious lying about the intelligence around the weapons of mass destruction that was contained in the contrast between last year's address and this year's. And you have to ask yourself what rationales are now in place for our continuing to be in Iraq and for the stark divergence between the selection process the administration wants to see in Iraq and the enormous demonstrations we saw this week in Iraq among Iraqis wanting a direct electoral process. And therein lies an additional very interesting tale.
Yeah, if we could only get people in the streets demanding a real electoral process in this country.
Well, and the other thing is, I mean, we had another interesting contrast this week between the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, which is an annual affair, and the World Social Forum in India. After the first 3 years of being Brazil, it's in India this year, and there are 80,000 people there, and it's a marvelous event that I'm sure we'll be hearing more about in the coming weeks. But Aaron Dottie Roy, a couple of days ago, in talking about that, was talking about how the same people who were in the streets over the past year protesting the invasion now need to be a movement to end the occupation, and she was suggesting campaigns of civil disobedience and protests targeting companies that were directly benefiting from the occupation. Just pick two, for instance, say randomly Halliburton and Bechtel, and go after their facilities all over the world that are, you know, part of a company that's profiting from an illegal invasion and illegal occupation.
With civil disobedience.
Right.
Yes.
Just want to clarify that.
Yes.
All right. Well, more developments as they happen every week in Iraq.
Beep.
Yes,
beep,
indeed.
Click,
I just want to start with the with this week in Iraq. I just want to start with the toll, the death toll. The number of U.S. troops death in Iraq has passed 500 now, for a total of 506, although this morning I woke up, two more U.S. troops had been killed, so it is now 508 dead since the war began on March 20th of last year. 53 U.S. troops have died since Saddam Hussein was captured on December 13th. 96 other troops, that includes British, Polish, Danish, Spanish, Italian, Ukrainian, Bulgarian, and Thai soldiers, have also died. An unknown number of civilian contractors from many different countries have also died, and that includes Americans, Britons, Kuwaitis, Saudis, and South Koreans. IraqBodyCount.org, the website where you can find some of this information, estimates that nearly 10,000 Iraqi civilians have died as a direct result of the armed attack. However, an unknown number have died from food shortages, lack of fuel to heat their homes and cook their food, lack of electricity to refrigerate food, and inadequate medical care because the hospitals are still in an absolutely appalling state now, 9 months after the end of major combat operations in Iraq.
Can I add one thing parenthetically about the numbers after the death of Saddam Hussein, or the capture, I mean, of Saddam Hussein, that those numbers actually are on a prorated basis, are an increase over the rate of deaths of U.S. soldiers before Saddam's capture.
It's actually about the same.
No, it's my understanding is it's actually a little bit higher than it has been in previous months.
Because there were, I believe, in the month before, around 70 to 80, and it's about 50. So I think it's about the same. I don't think it has actually gone up. It's actually gone up in the last 3 to 4 months over the previous three to 4 months, is my understanding. So another issue I want to talk about in this week in Iraq are that there's a, as Jav mentioned, there is a bit of a problem with the U.S. selection process as far as many of the Iraqis are concerned, particularly the majority of Iraqis, the Shiite population, who have been demanding an election process instead. And the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani came out at the end of last week and said that people should be out in the streets demanding an election process this week, because Paul Bremer would be meeting with Kofi Annan at the UN to discuss the prospects of changing the selection process and making it more democratic. Well, after the Ayatollah issued that order, there were some hundreds of thousands of people who turned out in the streets of Iraq this week for over the course of 4 to 5 days in cities like Basra and Baghdad and Karbala and Najaf, just all over the country. And not all of them were Shiites. Some of them were Sunni Muslims. Some of them were Kurds, demanding an election process instead of a selection process. Now, the U.S. is still holding firm. They don't want to make a significant change to the process that they have in place, which would set up caucuses, little town hall meetings that would then select people to sit on an interim legislature that would take over from the U.S. in June. Now, it's worth mentioning at this point that an election process is possible. Kofi Annan has been asked to send a team to Iraq to see whether it is possible to do an election, and the U.S. is asking him to basically send people who will sit in a hotel in Baghdad and then send letters out to Shiite leaders saying, I'm sorry, elections are not possible, you have to go with the U.S. plan, et cetera, et cetera. Kofi Annan has been a little hesitant to agree to that, and we can understand why.
For one thing, it's not true.
But yeah, it's not true. An election process is possible. Now, the main U.S. objection has been, well, we can't do a census, and the security prevents us from doing an election process. Well, if they said we will do an election process and they got the program going, I'm sure security would probably improve somewhat. There would be fewer people angry at the U.S. occupiers if an election process were in the works. And that might cut down on some of the attacks on U.S. soldiers and coalition troops. And there is already something that is better even than a regular U.S. census in place. There was the database that was kept. There were actually two databases kept for the Oil for Food program, a registry of people who were recipients of the Oil for Food goods during the Saddam Hussein era. Now, that database was updated on a monthly basis. Censuses are often taken only every couple of years or so. So it's very current and very accurate information. Now, there are a number of people who are not on those lists. Those people are people who were dropped off for political reasons, people that Saddam Hussein wanted to punish, or people who had to go into hiding from Saddam Hussein's police. Those people can be registered and added to the database. In addition, there are some Iraqi exiles who were not living in the country during the sanctions and who are not on the database. Those people can also be registered to vote. But that process needs to start right away in order for an election to occur in the middle of this year. And unfortunately, the Bush administration is dragging their feet and stalling and saying that no, they don't want to do it.
By the way, there's no magic there's no magic reason for the date of June 30th in the middle of this year, other than it's tied to the U.S. elections. But there's no particular reason that they have to have it on June 30th as opposed to, say, July 30th.
And that's the point that Ali Sistani had made, is that the reason why the Bush administration wants an Iraqi government in place on June 30th is because George Bush wants that to be in place for his election, in order to help his re-election campaign. So it is possible to hold elections in Iraq in spite of what the Bush administration is saying. And that is the main point I wanted to make on This Week in Iraq. Although I would like to mention, too, that the Halliburton scandal has widened somewhat. The Wall Street Journal reported on Friday that Halliburton had admitted that two of its employees in Kuwait had taken kickbacks in order to accept a Kuwaiti firm as a subcontractor to provide services to U.S. troops in Iraq. Now, that's an open admission that there is a real problem with Halliburton's selection process for subcontractors. And although Halliburton says it will pay back what it estimates to be $6.3 million in overcharges that the Pentagon paid because of these two employees of Halliburton, they haven't said that they will pay back the some $61 million in overcharges for fuel that was shipped into Iraq because the widening scandal.
Yeah, and that came out of the same office in Kuwait, the overcharges for the fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And one of the reasons also for accelerating the timetable on the government of Iraq is the legality that the privatization that the Bush administration wants to put in place, essentially the auctioning off of all of the former state companies of Iraq, cannot be done by an occupying government. It has to be done by an independent government.
Under international law.
And they're having trouble attracting international investors and capital because of that restriction as well. An elected government would not do that. A selected government would.
All right, we have to jump to events that are happening this week.
Yeah, and one coming up this morning, which you talked about the last couple of weeks, the fundraiser for Bert Sachs, the Iraq activist who has been back and forth to Iraq a number of times over the past decade, had a heart attack last month, has survived that quite nicely. In fact, he'll be there this morning, but he also has $57,000 in medical bills. So for people who are not planning to be at the breakfast this morning, you can find information on it, and you can donate anyway over the web at www.BertMedicalFund.org. That's B-E-R-T, Bert. Or you can scurry on down. United Temple, United Methodist Church, 15th and 43rd Northeast in the U District. That starts at 10:30. You were supposed to RSVP, but if you came up and waved around a fistful of dollars for Bert's medical care, I'm sure they'd let you eat a bagel or something. Also this week, Black Dollar Days Task Force is kicking off its annual Buy Local campaign. There will be a rally at New Hope Baptist Church at 5 o'clock Monday night. And don't forget, we'll talk about it next week, but coming up a week, next week, not this week, on February 3rd, two really important school district levies. So spread the word on that.
All right, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell people where they can find Eat the State.
It is a biweekly newspaper put out primarily by volunteers, which was one reason we're always hurting for money. It's a very shoestring operation, and we could use your donation. It's a newspaper that's handed out free of charge at places where you get free papers, and bookstores and cafes, places like that. You can also get it on the web, as well as all of our back issues at www.eatthestate.org, all one word. And if you have comments, tips, you'd like to volunteer, you have feedback on anything you've heard or anything you read in the paper, whatever.
You'd like to donate to us.
You'd like to donate. We do all of that. The voicemail for Eat the State is area code 206-903-9461.